So yesterday was the birthday of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And what I wanted to do today was to explore some of the connections between our practice, our Dharma practice, aiming at freedom and liberation, and the life and work of Dr. King. And I wanted to do so by exploring three common themes that we can find in our practice, whatever we call it, our Buddhist practice, our Dharma practice, three themes that are very connected between our own practice and the life and work of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And those three themes will be wisdom and understanding first, and then secondly, love and metta, the heart, the kind heart, secondly, and then thirdly, the theme of integrity. And what I'll be doing is exploring those three themes and then inviting us to focus on those themes in the next week. And my original intention was to complete this exploration today and to cover a lot of different themes. Like right in here, I have notes I made last night and this morning completing that were, named like 10 or 15 different themes I was going to explore. And then as I actually worked it up, I said, I think three is good. And so what that means is that I have a lot of material. A lot of material left, which I think is very interesting. And I also find that looking at the connection between our basic sense of practice that we get from the Asian Buddhist tradition especially, and looking at the sense of what we can call spiritual practice with the life and work of Dr. King, we have a kind of a dialogue which I think is very creative and very central to our own sense of practice at this time and place. So there's a lot there. And there's a lot that actually can be very creative when we have that dialogue. So that's my aim today, and I aim to continue that next week. And again, give us a sense of practice so we can have, if we wish, this next week quite continuous with the exploration of this theme in terms of our daily lives, how we are practicing, and just with those three themes. And if those three themes are too much, choose one. Anyway, so I'll explore that. So for many people, Dr. King may be the most significant moral and spiritual figure in the history of this country. A lot of people think that. I've seen that said by many people. In fact, the well-known writer and leader, Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, some of you may know, who marched with King in Selma in 1965 and was a refugee from Nazi Germany. He said that the future of America depends on, we might say, our response to the legacy of Martin Luther King. The very future of this country depends on how we respond to his legacy. So we can ask, how are we doing? It's a mixed picture, to say the least, right? But it's an interesting lens to hold up. So a little bit about his biography. Some of you know of his life. Born in 1929 in Atlanta. Atlanta, Georgia. His father, a minister. His mother played the organ in the church and was a choir leader. He was a very good student. He went to college at the age of 15. Went to Morehouse College. And he graduated at age 18. At age 18, he decided to become a minister. And he went to Morehouse Seminary in Pennsylvania. And then later went to Boston University as well, where he received a doctoral degree. At that point, he was 26 years old. He took his first ministerial appointment, as many of you know, in Montgomery, Alabama. Little did he know that he would be almost invited to help change history. And he was up to the task, as it were. So he was a minister there. And if you actually read some of the history or hear some of the accounts, he was a new face in Montgomery, and they were in the middle of what we would call civil rights struggles or movements there. And they invited him partly as a fresh face, maybe partly because they sensed his capacities. They invited him to become the leader of the movement. And then shortly thereafter, you know, Rosa Parks refused to get off the bus. 1955, the rest is history. They had a bus boycott. It lasted for a very long time and was ultimately successful. And he really went on to be a national leader as well, became president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, 1957, which was one of the groups, earlier groups, that played a very significant role and was very central for a number of different campaigns in different places, in Albany, Georgia, in Birmingham, Alabama, the March on Washington, 1963, movements that later went into the North, into Chicago and other areas. Again, many of you know this history. In his last year of life, he extended his concerns to more, shall we say, other systemic issues, other interconnected systemic issues of poverty, and he came out quite strongly in opposition to the Vietnam War. And I'll talk about that later. That was 1967. Gave a famous speech on April 4th, 1967, at the Riverside Church in New York City. We'll hear an excerpt of that a little bit later. And it was on April 4th, 1967, a year to the day later, he was assassinated, helping the sanitation workers in Memphis, Tennessee. So again, I want to explore the three themes relating both to our Dharma practice and to Dr. King's work: wisdom, understanding first, practices cultivating the kind heart, coming out of love, metta, second, and then thirdly, integrity, sort of wholeness of our being, and so forth. So these give some very... these are like some of the central pillars of our practice. So it's a nice, I think it's a nice choice, if I do say so myself. Okay, so first, wisdom. And this relates to the understanding of dukkha, or suffering, or reactivity. I would say that the center of the teachings of the Buddha and the center of the teachings of Dr. King are close to identical. Using different language. And the teachings are pretty simple. much of our practice is simple in concept, hard to do. Which is good. It'd be better if it was better than if it was complicated in concept and still hard to do. Right, so what's the essence? I think it comes down to that phrase I gave before. In Buddhist practice, it's dukkha and the end of dukkha. That's it. That's what we're up to. So how do we understand dukkha, and what does the end of dukkha mean? And I'll show, I think, how this is really the same understanding that we get in the nonviolence of Gandhi and King. So I think in the fall we actually looked some at the nature of dukkha. So a short summary, that in the teachings of the Buddha, there probably are 5 or 6 different meanings given to the phrase dukkha. And partly because it was an oral tradition, they're not all consistent. The Buddha it wasn't written down, so there wasn't any big systematization of all the teachings, and there were inconsistencies, and things weren't all lined up perfectly. That being said, there was a tremendous amount of internal coherence to the teachings, but on some of the points, it wasn't all easily lined up, and that could lead to both a certain amount of confusion and later efforts to make it really consistent, most of which, in my view, did not work very well. Another story. And so, one of these areas is dukkha. And so you find a lot of different understandings of dukkha, like I say, I think 5 or 6. So sometimes you find dukkha, and this is the meaning in ordinary language, in the language of the Buddha, it simply means that which is unpleasant, difficult, not quite right. You know, the etymology of the term, some of you know, is linked to an off-center axle on a cart. Right? So maybe you've heard that. And there's some way it's not quite right. Somewhat, also, dukkha would often be the word that would be used simply to mean the unpleasant, the difficult. And so the Buddha sometimes says, you know, illness is dukkha, old age is dukkha, and so forth. And that's one meaning. And there are a few other meanings as well. Sometimes it's said to be that there can be dukkha when things change. That when we have something good happen and it changes, that's a kind of dukkha, the Buddha said. And there also can be a kind of dukkha just in the fact that conditions are never quite perfect. Have you noticed? All the ducks are not lined up. Right. Mm. Eve Decker, who I mentioned earlier, has a song that she wrote where she says something like, I don't have it together and you don't have it together either. So that's one of the senses of dukkha. You know, some of you know, anyone know Susan's Moon book, The Life and Lessons, I think, of Tofu Roshi? Have you heard of Tofu Roshi, the famous Zen teacher? Fictional. And one of Tofu Roshi's Dharma talks was called How to Give Up Self-Improvement. That could be based on an understanding of dukkha, right? Like it's okay, I'm getting... Some self-improvement is okay. So just to be clear. Okay. So, but I think the central meaning of dukkha is one that I've sometimes given here on Wednesday mornings. And I think it's the most central meaning of dukkha for our practice is not dukkha as unpleasant or dukkha as change or even the nature of conditions. I think the teaching of dukkha that's most central to our practice we can understand dukkha as reactivity, the resistance to the present moment, not being okay with the present moment, either grabbing hold of it to get more of it or pushing it away. And this comes out in the teaching that really is maybe my favorite teaching of the Buddha, the teaching of the two arrows, which I give a lot, right? And that teaching is like this. The Buddha was talking to a group of practitioners, and he said, everyone at times has unpleasant experiences. How does a practitioner differ from a non-practitioner? If everyone has unpleasant experiences, then we could say that we have sometimes unpleasant physical experiences, sometimes unpleasant emotional experiences, difficult emotions, grief, sadness, fear, anxiety, and so forth. We have difficult thoughts. We have negative tape loops that go on in our minds, all of us. We have difficult interpersonal interactions. We have difficult situations in which we're not treated fairly or justly. All of this can occur. And this would come under what Buddhists called the first arrow. We're all sometimes shot by the first arrow. This is universal. Everyone experiences that. No difference between a practitioner and a non-practitioner. By the way, I like to say that a non-practitioner also means those who sometimes call themselves practitioners when they're not practicing. Which has been known to occur. Okay. And so everyone is sometimes shot by a first arrow. That is not the problem. So ultimately he's saying the presence of the unpleasant isn't the issue. And when we talk about dukkha and the end of dukkha, we're not trying to get rid of the unpleasant. Right? So when you hear someone say the aim is the end of dukkha, it obviously doesn't mean getting rid of everything that's unpleasant in our lives. The Buddha himself, you know, had some body issues when he was older. Near the last part of his life, he had headaches and he had a bad back. Right, very normal. Presumably, he had reached the end of dukkha, and so these were not an issue, right? That's the first arrow. What the Buddha said is the problem is that because of the first arrow, we tend to shoot a second arrow. In other words, we react. That we have unpleasant physical sensations, and we react. We can react physically. We tense around the unpleasant physical sensations. So I've heard that 80% of the pain of many people with chronic pain is the tensing around the pain. It's not the pain. It's only 20% is the actual pain. And we can see that very easily with interpersonal relationships, right? But with pain, even so, even that's the case. And so the first main application of mindfulness in the medical field, not surprisingly, was with chronic pain. Interesting, right? Because if you can eliminate the second arrow, the 80%, all of a sudden you have much less pain, right? And then, so shooting the second arrow would be tensing. Emotionally, it would be having something difficult happen, react, blame oneself, blame another. You know, we can have a unpleasant emotional experience that lasts for 10 seconds, and we can be preoccupied by it for how long? You know, certainly hours and days sometimes, right? Or longer, right? We can have difficult things happen that influence us. We react to it for 30 years or 50 years. Again, sometimes that's the best we can do. It's not to blame us, but we can react with emotionally, mentally, again, with our narratives, with our thoughts, difficult emotions, very clear interpersonally. Someone says something kind of mean to me, and I react back with something mean to that person. A lot of difficulties in relationships are two people shooting second arrows at each other, right? As if that would help get rid of the original unpleasant situation. As if that would help. Now that's because Why would we do it otherwise? And a lot of it's somewhat almost like hardwired, but that's the second arrow. And again, we can see how when we actually look carefully, we can also see that that is exactly the principle of nonviolence. We have received pain, we have received oppression, we will not simply react and give you pain and oppression in return, or give the oppressor that. We will actually not react, but respond. And so the teaching of the second arrow, or of the two arrows, is particularly to help us not shoot the second arrow. And sort of a clear way to talk about dukkha is to say that dukkha is shooting the second arrow. That's what we want to end. It's the reactivity. And in this case, particularly the reactivity that pushes away the unpleasant. In actuality, there are two main forms of reactivity. Another grabs hold of the pleasant. We react, I want that, I want more of that, and neither of them can really be in the present moment. Right? For the purposes of looking at the life of Dr. King, it's the reacting against the unpleasant, the difficult, the injustice, the oppression. How do we do that? And so this is where King said that for a long time he didn't think that it was possible to bring the what he called the love ethic of Jesus to social and political affairs. But he said it was only when I read Gandhi that I understood that it was possible. And so the notion of nonviolence from Gandhi and King, again, to me, it's the same core teaching as that of the two arrows. We have received the unpleasant. We will not habitually react. Right? There's a very, so again, very clear teaching, very hard to put into practice, right? But it's a clear direction, because it lets us look for our own patterns of shooting the second arrow. Notice our reactivity. So, you know, every practitioner, suddenly, you know, maybe we all came here for bliss, understanding, and light, but we become students of the many forms of our own reactivity. Again, I sometimes joke, it's not so clearly there in the promotional literature for Spirit Rock. Come, get to know really well the 10 ways you shoot the second arrow that are most prominent. Become a connoisseur of your forms of reactivity. Get to know them better than you ever imagined was possible. We'll try that maybe one season for the Spirit Rock literature and see what the attendance is like. I looked once and it's not quite there. It's a little bit impact. Anyway, I'm going on about it because, you know, anyway, more could be said, but I'll move on. So, in Dr. King's language, the same principle of the two arrows could be expressed like this. He would say, the means must be as pure as the end. It's abandonment of the doctrine, the end justifies the means. He said, the end represents the means in process and the ideal in the making. And so there was a clear intention to practice non-injury and to watch the tendencies of the reactive mind, again, to lash out in violence, to even to blame and judge, to demonize one's opponents. And so when you look at his work, you find a tremendous amount of empathy and heart. I'm getting a little ahead of myself because I'm kind of going into the heart area. You find a lot of empathy for people who were, quote, his opponents, right? And really very much like Gandhi said, at the end of our movement, I want the British out and I want them to be our friends. Right? And King talked about it as the aim of reconciliation. And creating what he called the beloved community. So one doesn't do that by reacting and using violence, force, negativity, and so forth. So it's really a perspective of sort of the unity of humanity, and could extend it to non-humans as well. And so that teaching, the teaching of the two arrows, the teaching of nonviolence, at the center, we could say, is developing non-reactivity and understanding of our deep, shared core of our being. Hence the sense of interdependence. And that's one way of talking about the wisdom dimension. And another lens, which really is quite parallel, is to look through the lens of love and metta. And right at the center of our practice is that cultivation of the kind heart. Sometimes traditionally it's said that the Dharma is like a bird with two wings. One wing is wisdom, one wing is compassion. And compassion really is shorthand for the open, kind heart. And we can find that sense that everything needs to come from the kind heart. In King's world, this would be called love. In the Buddhist world, it would be called metta, compassion, different expressions of the kind heart. So I've just come from co-teaching the metta retreat for a week. I actually haven't gone home yet. And so I still have a little bit of maybe more than a little bit of the metta energy. I can feel it. It's been all around. We, at the end of the retreat, this was originally Sylvia's idea. We everyone at the retreat, which was 97 people, plus the teachers and managers, we all sign a postcard by saying our name and writing it on this big postcard. It was like it was imaginary, but it was like 50, 100 feet big. And then we sent it off into space to all beings with everyone's signature. Right? And so I thought I'd read just to get a sense of, this amazing intention that human life can be centered around love and warmth and kindness, right? And that we can live like that, even with the way the world is, right? What an intention. Here's the text, the beginning of it. This is what should be done by those who are skilled in goodness and who know the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be at ease. With a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded. Freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, one should sustain this recollection. 2,600 years ago. Right, so we have this sense of this expression of our practice as continually bringing that kind heart, sometimes expressed as loving kindness. One of my co-teachers, Anushka Fernandapula, her phrase for metta is unstoppable friendliness. And actually the root, the etymological root of metta is actually related to words meaning friend. Right. Unstoppable friendliness or kindness, benevolence, goodwill. These are some of the other translations that have been there. And it's understood that our deep nature, in some of the texts, it's understood that our deep nature has this quality of warmth and kindness. Even those who have done very unskillful things have that same quality of heart and mind in their being. It just is covered over. So, in that sense, there's not a sense of evil beings. And there's no basis, ultimately, for demonizing or having any beings, any human beings, certainly, out of one's heart. That would only be there because there's reactivity. Gandhi said that nonviolence is the law of our being. He said the belief in nonviolence is based on the assumption that human nature in its essence is one and therefore unfailingly responds to the advances of love. Within human nature, there is an amazing potential for goodness. From Dr. King, I say to you, I have also decided to stick to love, for I know that love is ultimately the only answer to the problems of humanity. Hate is too great a burden to bear. I have decided to love. If you are seeking the highest good, I think you can find it through love. And he understood his social action as guided by love. I would say guided by love, guided by that wisdom of the 2 hours teaching, the equivalent. We're guided by wisdom, we're guided by the kind heart. That's our practice. And he said, you even love your enemies. And again, here he's following the teachings of Jesus. He said, I'm glad that Jesus said, love your enemies rather than like them. Because there are some people, this is King, there are some people that I find it pretty difficult to like. Liking is an affectionate emotion, and I can't like anybody who would bomb my home. I can't like anybody who would exploit me. I can't like anybody who would trample over me with injustice. I can't like them. I can't like anybody who threatens to kill me day in and day out. But Jesus reminds us that love is greater than liking. Love is understanding, creative, redemptive goodwill towards all human beings. So he makes that distinction. In metta practice, this is like developing metta for the difficult person. We do it near the end. It's advanced practice. Right? And so, but King is saying that I can have that aspiration to love. And it's almost like a different part of our mind than the liking or disliking. It's interesting, right? Interesting how he goes there. And he has that sense that with love, we use love and understanding to defeat the unjust system. That's the basis for our action. Again, a lot of people would say impractical, right? But that's what they did. It worked for Gandhi, a lot of successes for Dr. King. And so the attempt, again, relates to the earlier points, the attempt is to defeat the unjust system, not the individuals. The individuals are not the problem. It's the system that's the problem. Yeah. The system, the cultural ideas, and so forth. But again, this in Christian language, this would be to say you criticize the action, not the person. You know, and I told this story 2 days ago, but I think I'll tell it again. You know, my mom, I think, brought us up in my family with this, and I heard the story that one day my brother had done something she didn't like. And she said, I really love you, but what you did, dot, 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 and she went off and talked about how she, you know, that wasn't so good, but I love you. And he responded, don't talk to me like a psychologist, just spank me like the other parents do. Right, so, but that's the approach with coming out of love. Because, of course, the question is, how do you come out of wisdom and love and still deal with difficult situations, right? How do you deal with injustice? And, you know, King, Gandhi, they give us a sense of how to do that. And again, we can, you know, part of our practice, how do we come with wisdom and love to the difficult situations in our lives, to our difficult interactions? How do we prevent ourselves from just being reactive, shooting the second arrow? That's our practice, right? Not easy. Right? We get lost continually. We mess up continually. So maybe in one of the other talks, I'll bring in forgiveness more, because compassion and forgiveness become really, really core heart qualities in this practical path, because we're going to keep on messing up, right? So to speak. The third theme, this is the last theme I want to explore, and then we'll have a chance to talk together, is that of integrity. And integrity can mean different things. I think it means wholeness, especially. It means that our practice and our deeper values are there for everything in our lives increasingly, not just part of it. It's not like we're meditators and we're really good on the cushion, but half an hour later, right? And so there's something in our practice which really calls us to have that, whatever we call it, the moral, spiritual consistency. You know, integrity is a good word. It means that sense of coherence, wholeness, maybe authenticity, a seamlessness about our lives. It's not about perfection, because wholeness can include imperfection, really crucial point. But how do we bring our practice to all the parts of our lives, including the difficult ones? That is, we could say, integrity and wholeness. In the traditional teachings, there were three aspects of training. Sila, Samadhi, and Panya. Ethical training. Training in meditation. Samadhi is code for that. So ethical training, which has to do with our relationships, being in community, meditative training, and then wisdom, which in a way covers everything. And so there's a certain way that traditionally Buddhist practice covered all the parts of life. One of the issues, we might say, in the way that Buddhist practice has come to the West is that we really have focused primarily on meditation. Which is understandable historically, because the meditative dimensions were somewhat taken out of the Western religions. So we can understand, and the inner dimension has been somewhat lost in Western culture for like, you know, 1,000 years, broadly speaking. So it's understandable, but it has its issues. It has its problems. And so the traditional model, I think we can see that wholeness, and one of our root problems may be that we think, you know, sometimes people say, how's your practice doing? And they mean your practice on the cushion. But shouldn't our practice be everything? Right? That's that sense of integrity. It was a crucial issue for King. And he, you know, he did have his own shadow territory, his own imperfections, I would say particularly around gender and sexuality. Some of you know the history. You know, but he was very interested in integrity. And one of the places where it really came out, I'm just going to focus on one aspect, was his decision to speak out on Vietnam in 1967. You know, he hesitated for a number of years. I think it was said, he said that he was always against it, but he thought that if he spoke out, it would interfere with the collaboration with President Johnson and with getting civil rights bills through, which makes a certain amount of strategic sense. But it must have been painful, because he wanted his nonviolence to be consistent. Right? And so he went through a period of anguish around that, and eventually came to speak. I'm going to play the first 5 or 6 minutes of the speech where he actually came out and spoke and described some of his own kind of journey of anguish to come to integrity. Now, why don't I do that right now? So this is Dr. King, April 4th, 1967, speaking at the Riverside Church in New York City.
Come to this magnificent house of worship tonight because my conscience leaves me no other choice. I join you in this meeting because I'm in deepest agreement with the aims and work of the organization which has brought us together, clergy and laymen concerned about Vietnam. The recent statements of your executive committee are the sentiments of my own heart, and I found myself in full accord when I read its opening lines. A time comes when silence is betrayal. And that time has come for us in relation to Vietnam. The truth of these words is beyond doubt, but the mission to which they call us is a most difficult one. Even when pressed by the demands of inner truth, men do not easily assume the task of opposing their government's policy, especially in time of war. Nor does the human spirit move without great difficulty against all the apathy of conformist thought within one's own bosom and in the surrounding world. Moreover, when the issues at hand seem as perplexing as they often do, in the case of this dreadful conflict, we are always on the verge of being mesmerized by uncertainty. But we must move on. And some of us who have already begun to break the silence of the night have found that the calling to speak is often a vocation of agony, but we must speak. We must speak with all the humility that is appropriate to our limited vision, but we must speak. And we must rejoice as well, for surely this is the first time in our nation's history that a significant number of its religious leaders have chosen to move beyond the prophesying of smooth patriotism to the high grounds of a firm dissent based upon the mandates of conscience and the reading of history. Perhaps a new spirit is rising among us. If it is, let us trace its movement and pray that our own inner being may be sensitive to its guidance. For we are deeply in need of a new way beyond the darkness that seems so close around us. Over the past 2 years, as I have moved to break the betrayal of my own silences and to speak from the burnings of my own heart, as I have called for radical departures from the destruction of Vietnam, many persons have questioned me about the wisdom of my path. At the heart of their concerns, this query has often loomed large and loud. Why are you speaking about the war, Dr. King? Why are you joining the voices of dissent? Peace and civil rights don't mix, they say. Aren't you hurting the cause of your people, they ask. And when I hear them, though I often understand the source of their concern, I'm nevertheless greatly saddened, for such questions mean that the inquirers have not really known me, my commitment or my calling. Indeed, their questions suggest that they do not know the world in which they live. In the light of such tragic misunderstanding, I deem it of signal importance to try to state clearly, and I trust concisely, why I believe that the path from Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, the church in Montgomery, Alabama, where I began my pastorate, leads clearly to this sanctuary tonight. I come to this platform tonight to make a passionate plea to my beloved nation.
So the whole talk is about 1 hour. But you got a sense of that anguish and loneliness. And in fact, the day after the speech, there were extremely negative editorials, I think, in both the New York Times and the Washington Post. He lost a lot of support. It's not so well known at this time now, but in the last year of his life, he was not well regarded by many. There was a Harris poll in the beginning of 1968, and his popularity rating, I think it was, his public disapproval rating was 75%. You know, newspapers, magazines, all came out with criticism. So we can sense that as his own, you can hear that, his own attempt to have integrity. So what I want to suggest for next week is that we practice with possibly all three of these themes. Wisdom and non-reactivity, cultivating the kind heart, and integrity. And we can do that in different ways. You know, in terms of the first, we'll go into a lot more detail on Sunday if you want to really do it. Okay. But, one way to do it would be to really track for your own reactivity. Set the intention every morning. It's a beautiful daily life practice, really interesting. Right? If reactivity comes up, I'm going to study it, I'm going to notice it, I'm going to try as much as I can not to shoot the second arrow. We can know that if something difficult happens, there will be tendencies to shoot the second arrow. Something difficult happens, or you think of something difficult, know that that's likely to bring up the second arrow, so then you can track for it, right? It's probably the most common guidance that I give to people with whom I work one-on-one. They're talking about something difficult, and I say, watch out for the shooting of the second arrow. I say that more than anything else I say in working with people. So that's a way to look at it. You know, and it can be small things, big things, you know. Find ways not to act out. Easier said than done. If you do act out, go back and study it. Well, maybe next time you can do forgiveness practice as well, right? Advanced practice is driving. Watch for non-reactivity. Forgiveness practice is a major practice I do when driving. Just cut me off. Forgiveness practice. That's kind of a segue to the second point. Find a way to cultivate the kind heart. If you know metta practice, do it every day for 10 minutes a day. Find ways of cultivating the kind heart. Could be metta practice, loving kindness practice, compassion practice. Working with intention goes a long way. You have a difficult meeting, difficult interaction with someone, difficult conversation. Bring the intention to have loving kindness, maybe also empathy. Empathy is a sort of an expression of the kind heart. Can be. Look for where there are challenges to the kind heart being there. Again, not an easy practice. What situations does the kind heart vanish? What's difficult for you? So that would be a second one. So study what's challenging, bring in the heart practices, work with intention. And then the third would be just to look at one's life and look at, where am I integrity? Where might I have more integrity? Is there an area of my life I want to bring more integrity to? Again, not from the perspective of judging ourselves or blaming, but more inquiry. Again, we have to hold it with some compassion and understanding of our own, what, foibles, imperfections, right? Compassion. So maybe two quotations from Dr. King to end. Love is the only force capable of transforming an enemy into a friend. We never get rid of an enemy by meeting hate with hate. We get rid of an enemy by getting rid of enmity. By its very nature, hate destroys and tears down. By its very nature, love creates and builds up. Love transforms with redemptive power. So we can hear there the merging of the wisdom and the love, right? The understanding of nonviolence, non-reactivity, with the connection with love. And then last part from Dr. King is just one sentence. And this came from in the Birmingham movement, 1963, they had the King developed, I think he developed it probably, or one of his assistants. Everyone who participated in the movement had to sign a statement, which was the 10 commandments of a nonviolent soldier. Very good. Maybe I'll bring the other ones in. But I just focused on one of them to end because it sort of summarizes the integrity part. Okay, here it is. It's short, so listen. Okay. Number 3. Walk and talk in the manner of love. The third commandment of a nonviolent soldier. Birmingham, 1963. Walk and talk in the manner of love. So again, those three themes, the wisdom, love, metta, kind heart, and integrity. So, how many would like to practice those for the next week and come back and compare notes? Or even if you can't be here. Okay, that's okay. Okay, great. And maybe just take a moment to reflect on how you might do that. How would I bring these practices into my daily life in the next week? Thank you. And again, thank you for your kind listening. And we have some time, maybe about 10 minutes, for any questions, discussion, points. And we want to use the microphone. So why don't we say our names before we speak? Yeah. I think person right behind you wants to speak.
Speaking of the second arrow and integrity, Dr. King spoke about for years he struggled with his conscience, right?
Yeah.
It seems there was a lot of second arrows probably happening in there. What am I doing? Why am I not doing this? You know, you should be, whatever. Can you speak to how... or some techniques or the connection between the urge to integrity and the second arrow and how to act without the second arrow, without the need for the second arrow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, how to act, how to explore when the second arrow is there, how to act. Using simple language, we could say that it's about non-reactive action. Or another way, we sometimes use the word response rather than reaction. And the reaction tends to be non-mindful, automatic, semi-conscious or unconscious. And so I think ultimately there's a sense, you find this in multiple traditions, Taoist tradition especially, there's a sense that when we move away from the reactivity, it's like our core nature is pretty good. And there's a sense almost of almost like of natural action that comes out of compassion. When those qualities are there, compassion, kindness, mindfulness, equanimity, it's related to qualities like patience, like generosity, and connection. And so generally the aim of practice is to, it really could be summarized in two ways. It's to see the reactive tendencies, the conditioned tendencies, and to work through them on the one hand, and then to bring out these other qualities, these beautiful awakened qualities on the other, and have our action increasingly come out of them, right? And so, I mean, that's what, you know, King might have said something similar when he talks about acting out of love. And so there's a purification process that occurs as we work through our reactivity. It's not like it, you know, we can work through old patterns. It's not like they're, you know, the neural pathways never go away, but they become weaker, is one way to say it in a scientific way. Right, as we have new neural pathways, we could say that awakened qualities are new neural pathways. They get stronger. It doesn't mean we don't relapse, but they're just more there. So does that get at it some?
Yes, thank you. I guess the one thing is we have those. I think there's a thing in the mind that thinks if we don't have that prompting of the second arrow, we won't act. If we don't have the prompting of the second arrow, you should do this.
Oh, I see.
We don't act.
Yeah, yeah. That brings out another point that I would say, and this is, again, King would talk about this, or Buddhist activists like Thich Nhat Hanh would say, yeah, the motivation for action may change. That's interesting, right? And so what does activism look like that's motivated by compassion and love as opposed to reactive anger? And I'll be brief here because I want to make room for other people as well, but maybe we can look at it next time. King said that the transformation of anger is at the center of our movement, and it's a big theme here. And so anger itself is not necessarily reactive. Anger can put us in touch with deep values. And so skillfully working with anger can be quite central. Please. Thank you.
I mostly just wanted to thank you. I found this like really moving, and sometimes when we're in here and we're talking about nonviolent communication and metta and all of these things, it can feel ungrounded from the real world. Like, how do we practice this in a world that can feel so difficult and challenging? And it really just grounded it for me. So I also wanted to maybe invite you from my own personal standpoint, if you wanted to bring in other masters like this. I know I would.
In talks, yeah.
In talks, yeah. It really just like grounded it in the real world.
Yeah.
I had one other comment. Maybe that's enough. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. And, you know, I also wanted there, you know, in my notes that I was developing, I had like I said, 10 or 15 points, of which I dealt with three, right? And so I was, you know, some of it was also a little more dialogue, like where can Dharma practice learn from Dr. King? Where can Dr. King learn from Dharma practice, so to speak? Or, you know, where are there limitations of either? And so, yeah, but to bring in other major figures like that, I hear that. Thank you.
Hi.
Yvonne.
Is it on? When something happens that I feel really bad about, that would be the first arrow. And then it's like three or four arrows later.
Yeah.
It's like I'm aware of the third or fourth arrow, and I tell myself saying no more arrows.
Yeah.
But it's like, so I catch it, the subsequent arrows. But I'm just wondering, is that kind of like cultivating the ability to perhaps catch the next arrow.
Yeah. Just
recognizing that you've had the subsequent ones.
That's a good, it's a great question. The second arrow is a term that is shorthand for the second through the 1,583rd. Right. It keeps happening. It is shorthand because the reaction of from the reaction keeps occurring. So whenever we can notice it, it's helpful, you know, because it stops the process. Then we have to, you know, work to some extent with maybe some, hold it with compassion or care or forgiveness, so we don't blame ourselves for having shot the second arrow. But as wherever we notice it, then, you know, hopefully the reactive process stops, at least for the time being. And that's very positive. So, and then we can, again, learn from it. It can be helpful. This is something for our daily life practice. It can be helpful at the end of the day to review, where were the two or three times I shot the second arrow most? What was the trigger, right? What triggered me? Because we want to know, what are my particular triggers? We will each have our own, right? And to know that is important, because then we're going into a situation where we're likely to be triggered. You can go in with some, okay, I'm going to bring some tools here, right? And so it really is helpful to study our own patterns and know, okay, I get triggered. You know, like personally, when I was studying a lot of this, and it still happens, I notice when I think someone hasn't really heard me or listened to me, it's probably a lot of us can feel that, I get triggered, right? Someone's not really listening. I don't feel heard or met or whatever. And helpful to know that, right? And then that can help, yeah. So please.
So
maybe think last one, yeah.
I'll make it good.
I'm kidding. Last but not least.
This is very helpful for me because it kind of brought to the forefront something I've been sort of almost unconsciously struggling with, and that is, on Facebook, I have friends who are vehemently one political approach that offends me. But I also have friends who have the political approach that I subscribe to, but their vitriol and their anger and the things that they post also upset me. And so I keep thinking, well, maybe I'll just go off Facebook. But more than anything, what you brought to mind is either side is upsetting because of the level of anger and hatred that is in there.
That's
and,
right, yeah.
You know, so I don't want to hear this about the people who I oppose any more than I want to hear about the people that I support. So it just kind of made that clearer for me that I don't think it's like having the second arrow just to expose yourself to that when you don't want to be experienced.
There's a lot there, what you say, that so much of what passes for commentary or discourse is full of the second arrow.
Yeah.
And having you know, some insight, let's say, into injustice or something that's problematic can go hand in hand with shooting the second arrow. And so I think what, you know, as with King and Gandhi's work, all of this is pointing towards a whole different modality of responding to issues and problems and a vision. You know, they had the vision of reconciliation. That would lead one to talk differently with those with whom you differ, right? You know, and so actually, you know, emphasizing empathy and understanding, really crucial for our times. You know, I remember there was someone, I think it was a guy named, I forget his name, a writer for the San Francisco Chronicle, in I think October 2016, he said, what this country most needs is empathy. Which is understood as the ability to hear with interest another person, even if there's a difference. Not easy, right? Again, but it's really possible. I remember I sometimes tell the story, I'll end with this. I taught for 4 years at the University of Kentucky in Lexington, Kentucky. And I taught a lot of ethics classes. And we dealt with hot button issues. You know, in Kentucky, we dealt with coal, and we dealt with abortion. But people were really, when I gave a framework of really hearing other people and listening to them with interest, they all went along. And we could go into intense discussions of abortion with people who call themselves fundamentalists. It was done with respect and kindness and listening, and that's possible. In fact, people are nourished by it, you know, and it's what we deeply need. So that would be, you know, some of us may choose to act in that way, just having dialogues based on respect and empathy and interest clearly is part of what would be helpful and healing at this time, you know. So maybe some of us will lead that. So thank you. Yeah, we'll continue with that. So let's sit to close. We'll do traditional dedication of merit. First, again, just come back to what's your intention leaving our session? Maybe bringing this into the next week. What's your intention? And then we offer the fruits of our session, of our practice, to ourselves, to each other. And then beyond these boundaries of the hall, out into the world for the benefit of all. So our practice is ultimately for the benefit of all, and that includes us. To be continued.